We are talking today with Robert Fisk. Robert Fisk is a best-selling author and journalist who has lived in the Middle East for 3 decades. He is currently the Middle East correspondent for The Independent and lives in Beirut. He has covered 11 major wars and countless insurgencies, including the 1979 Iranian Revolution, the 1980-1988 Iran-Iraq War, the 1991 Persian Gulf War, and he was one of the first journalists to visit the scene of the Sabra and Shatila massacre. He has received numerous awards, including Amnesty International's UK Press Award in 1998 for his reports from Algeria, and again in 2000 for his articles on the NATO air campaign against Yugoslavia in 1999. In addition, he has also been named British Press Awards International Journalist of the Year 7 times. His books include The Point of No Return, The Strike Which Broke the British in Ulster, In Time of War, Ireland, Ulster, and the Price of Neutrality, 1939-45, Pity the Nation, The Abduction of Lebanon, The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East, and his latest book, The Age of the Warrior, Selected Essays by Robert Fisk. Robert, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
You're welcome.
Start out and tell us, what was the motivation in writing your latest book, The Age of the Warrior?
Well, I'd finished writing the Great War for Civilization, which is an ironic title. I got it from the medal which my father got at the end of the First World War. He was much older, my dad, than my mum, so he was actually in the Third Battle of the Somme. And it was that war that, you know, produced the modern Middle East, where I've spent more than half my life now. But after I'd finished that, and before I sort of started the companion volume, I wanted to try and put together a collection of articles going back a long way, which had no real place in these books. Articles which were not necessarily about the Middle East, which I'd never otherwise have a chance to put into book form. Mostly about my own obsessions, movies, cliches in journalism, death to some extent. I wrote about a lot of films that I like and a lot of films I hate. The mass grave of the Titanic victims, because I've always been fascinated by the Titanic. It went down April 14th, 1912, on my father's 13th birthday. He remembered the crowds gathering in Liverpool to read the names of the passengers who'd died. Well, they didn't know then how many had died, of course, and how many had survived. And, of course, Iraq is there, and quite a lot of my bitterness about our own former dear Prime Minister, Mr. Tony Blair, and quite a lot of angry comments on your present, soon-to-be, no longer incumbent President George W. Bush. So it's a political book, and it's also a book about a lot of the things that foreign correspondents don't get the chance to write about, because I have a weekly column that the editor says, write what you like. You can write about the Middle East, Lebanon, Iraq, Afghanistan, or you can go to New Zealand and write about the history of British colonialism in faraway places. So that's pretty much what I did, and because I do a lot of lecturing and travel a lot, even to places like Brazil, I'm able to write from countries which have no connection to the Middle East at all, just to get my mind off all the wars I cover. So it was fun to write it. It actually took a long time to put it together, because you can't put a series of articles chronologically. It doesn't work. I don't write chronological books. I like movies, so I start at the present and go back to the past and move it forward again. And I did the same with that book, and I divided it up into things like, you know, movies, poetry, war, Shakespeare and war, for example. There's a very long article on, did Shakespeare actually see war with his own eyes? I think he did not. He certainly talked to Elizabethan soldiers who'd been on the continent fighting for Queen Elizabeth I. But oddly enough, there's a lot in Shakespeare about the Islamic world. I mean, Othello was a Moor. He was a Muslim. Caliban in The Tempest was a Muslim. He's portrayed as a very wicked and evil person in The Tempest. So there's a lot of the articles come from books I've read on, about books I've read on aeroplanes and churches I go into in New Zealand and suddenly find all these memorial tablets to British New Zealand soldiers who died in Afghanistan in the very same places in the 19th century that they are dying in today. Because the British, of course, are back near Kandahar, which is exactly where they were in 1882. And in Kabul, which is where the largest British army of the Victorian age was slaughtered in 1842. I'm one of those people who likes to carry history books into wars rather than, clippings and bits off the internet, which I don't use anyway.
What was your motivation in becoming a journalist?
You're not going to believe this. It was a Hitchcock movie. When I was 12 years old, I saw a film called Foreign Correspondent. It was starring Joel McCrea. If your film buffs will know who he was. And he plays a... It was made in 1940. And he plays an American reporter called Humphrey Haverstock, working for the New York Daily News or some, you know, mythical newspaper. And his editor realizes there's going to be a war in Europe. It's set just on the outbreak of the Second World War. The editor says, "What we need in Europe is a crime correspondent," which is what you need in the Middle East at the moment. And he sends his crime correspondent, Huntley Haverstock, to Europe. And the guy sees the assassination of a Dutch politician. He's chased by the Gestapo in Holland, and he uncovers a top German spy in London. And he's shot down by a German pocket battleship over the Atlantic and lives to file his scoop. And he wins the most gorgeous woman in the movie. And I thought, age 12, I thought, this sounds like the kind of job I'd like to have, you know. Never turned out to be quite like that. But that was the movie. After I saw that, I never wanted to be anything except a foreign correspondent, a journalist. Age 12. I went to university. I did Latin and linguistics for my first degree. I did politics for my PhD. But just journalism is what I wanted to do. It was a bug. It's a disease you get in your bloodstream.
So how did you go about that? Did you, when you're done with school?
Immediately after I left school and before I went to university, I wanted to work on a local daily paper in Britain. I wanted to skip the weekly paper because I thought that if you work for a daily, you'd make your way to London more quickly because you had the experience of deadlines quicker and quicker. And I went to Newcastle upon Tyne to join the Newcastle Evening Chronicle. And I was sent to the Blythe District Office, which was a rundown coal port of, you know, shipyards that had gone bankrupt and coal mines that were closing and strikes. It was a totally socialist town, and it was always smothered in this sort of grime of, you know, wet, muggy clouds and coal smoke. It was steam locomotives. It was a very grim place to start off. But, you know, I was 17 years old and earning the equivalent of about $23 a week at today's rates, and most of which went to my landlady, a very tough lady called Mrs. Hamilton. And there I learned to report, you know, like all cub reporters do in local papers in the States too, you know, the law courts, the local, you know, lifeboat guild, the Women's Institute, this kind of thing, and that one's contacts were on the local council and so on. So I started off, and every Friday we'd have to go into Newcastle to be taught journalism. And they taught us clichés, always in clichés. They never taught us how to write well. They wanted us to write, you know, the police would always step up their hunt or narrow their hunt for a suspect. Scientists were always called boffins. Company chairmen were always called bosses. Ships always limped into port. You know, I'd never seen a ship limping in my life. Tanks always rolled over borders. Tanks don't roll. You know, they smash over borders. They don't roll. And the idea was that the readers of the paper wanted to read in this sort of simplified, artificial, cliche-ridden language. And I couldn't understand. I became very good at it and desperate not to write like that ever again. And in a way, I think, you know, it helps one to write in a more imaginative way. I don't mean imaginative fictionalized. I mean imaginative, you know, trying to get across to the reader what it's actually like to be in a place like, you know, the Middle East, for example, in a war or whatever. But I do remember that we were expected to write in these appalling cliches. You know, people would always be jet-setting. MPs will always be going off on foreign jaunts and will be attacked in the local council for not spending their holidays in the northeast of England, you know, in the rain and cold. But that's, you know, politicians always lash out at each other. I mean, some of these cliches pop up pretty regularly in the States and the local papers when I drift around places like Denver and, who knows, Seattle. They pop up in the papers here too. But it gave me a good grounding in, you know, getting your facts right in stories. But it also alerted me to the fact that if we carry on writing in cliches, I think circulations will collapse. You know, it's the language of the news agency. And I have to say, opening one paper here this morning, almost every page said Associated Press as the dateline on it, you know. It's rather sad in a way, because I think that if journalists try to write well, newspapers will have more readers. I don't think circulations are going down necessarily because of the internet or because of the economic climate or because they're not appealing to young people. I think they're not written very well.
So how did you then get into covering conflicts?
Well, I joined the Sunday Express, which is a pop paper. We'd now call it a red top. And I was running the diary column there for a time, so I was chasing vicars who'd run off with starlets. It was very good practice in the Middle East, of course. And after 3 years of this drivel, I couldn't stand it anymore. And by chance, I had a friend who was the oil correspondent on the Times of London. This is before Rupert Murdoch gobbled it up. And he arranged for me to have, in those days, it was tough to join the Times. It was, you know, the most prestigious paper in Britain. And I went through 13 or 18 interviews to get on it. And they did take me on the staff, and I was almost immediately sent to Northern Ireland, where the Troubles, as we called them then, it was a civil war, low-intensity civil war, had just begun. And then I was appointed Belfast correspondent after a year. You know, I was only in my very early 20s. I'd been to university by then. And, well, you know, I started seeing the first dead bodies, people who'd been shot by the British or shot by the IRA or blown to bits. And after 5 years in Belfast, and also covering Dublin as well, I went to Portugal to cover the aftermath of the Portuguese Revolution. This was 1975. And I was there on a beach. The Civil War had begun in Lebanon in 75. I'd actually been to Beirut on holiday from Belfast, but it wasn't a war then. Beirut was quiet. It was peaceful. Although I think I saw a few signs that something was going to go wrong there. And then I was sitting on a beach in Portugal in a place called Porto Covo when the postmistress came down and told me in Portuguese that I had a very important letter and it had been stamped in London, registered for me. And it was from my then foreign editor, Louis Heron, long dead now, I'm afraid. And he told me that the Times correspondent in Beirut, Paul Martin, had just got married to a millionaireess baroness, German, and that she did not intend to live her first days of weeks, months of her married life in a civil war, and they were going to go to Paris, and would I like to be the Middle East correspondent? And by this stage, I was 29. I felt like King Faisal being offered Iraq by Winston Churchill. So I always remember the letter. It said, if you want to take this job, it will be a great adventure with lots of sunshine. Say that last bit again. It certainly was. Anyway, I said yes, and I went off to Beirut, and we had an apartment there, the paper did. And I put my things in it, you know, my briefcase and my bag, went out to report the war on the front line in Beirut, came back, and the whole building was on fire. It had been hit by a shell. So that was the end of the Times office on day one, and then I found another apartment and moved into it. And I've been in the same building ever since. And, of course, I stayed on with the Times until, 1987, 88. By that time, Murdoch had arrived and begun to move the paper to the right, inevitably, of course. And so I fled to a new newspaper then called The Independent, where many of my colleagues from the Times had also sought, you know, political refuge. And I carried on with the same job in the same place, almost with the same salary, but writing for The Independent. And that's how I've got the same job now, and I'm still doing the same assignment.
So along the way, did you feel that you had finally attained that original adventure of the foreign correspondent?
Yes. There's no doubt that up till about 1981, 82... from 76 to 82, you know, that's 6 years, it was a big adventure for me. I was a young man. I had this wonderful job on this huge newspaper. I was getting press awards. People liked what I was writing from the heart, you know, not the agency type materials. I'd escaped from the Evening Chronicle and the Sunday Express. And the Islamic Revolution in Iran was this titanic, you know. I met Khomeini, and it was like a widescreen epic, you know, millions every day you saw in the streets, and you saw street battles, and then the Iran-Iraq war began, and so did the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. I remember watching these huge convoys of Soviet armor and tanks coming through the snow over the Hindu Kush, you know, the armies of Stalingrad invading a Muslim nation. You were watching history. It was stunning, you know. And then the Iran-Iraq war began, and at the beginning it was, you know, we were in the front line with both the Iraqi troops, and then we'd go to Tehran and join the Iranian troops in their front lines. Terrible war, I mean, 1.5 million. It was very like my father's First World War. They were in trenches and used gas, you know. But there was one episode I remember when a British ship was trapped in the Shatt al-Arab River outside Basra. That's the river that divides Iran and Iraq at that point. And they were being fired at from both sides. And Jon Snow, who was an anchorman on British television now, but was then a correspondent like me, I kept the same job, he's moved up. He was asked if by the ship's owners, could he rescue the crew? And he took me along because I managed to get some Admiralty maps of the Shatt al-Arab River. And we went up on this lone island at night with Iraqi commandos. The Iraqi army were on our side, you see. They were the good guys then. And John went off in his frogman's uniform in a rubber boat that almost went adrift and drifted off towards Iran. And my job was to stay on the shore with a rope and pull the lifeboat down from the British ship with all the crew in once it was brought to me. And the worst thing was this island, it was actually a plantation of palm trees. And it was partly waterlogged, so you were walking, you know, up to your knees and above in water. Hot water, of course, this is the Gulf. Mud and animals in it. And all the people had left the village, but they'd left their dogs behind. So every time you moved, all these dogs go, row, 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 and immediately you'd have this tracer bullets whizzing across hip height from the Iranian side of the river trying to seek you out. You know, very frightening. Anyway, we got the crew off, and I pulled the boat ashore, and, you know, John was the hero of the eye. He managed to get onto the boat in his frogman's uniform and arranged for them to be winched down. And the saddest thing was, being a British ship, most of the crew were Sri Lankan or Pakistani, and they'd all come ashore with all their duty-free goods, which they'd bought in Dubai before they sailed for Iraq. Because I had to take these expensive new fridges and colour TVs and chuck them in the river. We couldn't carry this stuff out. You know, they were more upset about me destroying all their duty-free than they were about the bullets that were whizzing around us. And I remember we got back, and I wrote a lovely story about... I mean, I wrote about John primarily, of course, because he was the guy who took all the risks. I didn't want to get involved in the shooting match at the beginning. And it was, you know, it was a great adventure. When I was writing about it in my book, The Great War for Civilization, I was writing it in Ireland, actually. And I went to see a dear friend of mine who was staying with me, and I said, you know, everything that follows this was awful. It's just massacres and betrayal and torture, all the stories that I wrote. And she said, ah, that is the end of the sweet stories. And the paragraph after I've told the story of John and me and the boat begins, but that is the end of the sweet stories, because after that it was mass killings and the Iran-Iraq war, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. I was in Sabra Shatila during the massacre. It was still going on. I was climbing over corpses that were, you know, decaying and decomposing underneath me. And from then onwards, I mean, I realized it was a very distressing book to write, the previous book, because, you know, as a journalist, you go to wars, but, you know, then you go home on holiday or it's Christmas and you have all these breaks. But if you take all the breaks out and you push it all together, you realize what the people who live in the Middle East go through. They don't have these breaks. They spend their whole life in this misery and suffering. And it was a very depressing book to write. But after that period, both in my own life and in the way I wrote, and comes out very clearly. It comes out in this new book, actually, to some extent. I took a much more pessimistic view of the world and of human beings, I think.
Do you think from the things you've witnessed and experienced and written on that you have ever suffered from similar to PTSD?
I'm not sure what it is. I tend not to be very sympathetic about journalists suffering from traumas. Or can they cope? You know, how do they come to terms with things? This sort of anthropological. It's sort of the language of therapy, isn't it? You know, we're quite privileged people. If we don't want to go on reporting wars, we can fly home business class with a glass of champagne. We don't have to stay there. The people whose traumas you should be worried about are the people who have pariah passports, no green cards, no visas, can't leave, and day and night try to keep their families and their wives and their husbands and their parents alive. So I think that, you know, our job is to catalogue their suffering, not to worry about ourselves. The only time I ever had a nightmare was after Sabra Shatila, and I woke up in the night and believed that the corpses I'd seen all day were piled on the bed beside me. And the reason was that my clothes smelled, because I'd been wearing them, of course, and they smelled of bodies. But apart from that, I've never had a nightmare or a bad dream. I can cover wars and get home and go out to dinner. You have to be very tough to work in the Middle East, you know, and take the sticks and stones, sometimes literally. And I think if you don't want to do it, you can leave. And if you want to watch history in this most terrible form, and if you want to see human folly, you've got to go to the Middle East. Well, there it is. After I'd done the book tours of my last book in France and Holland, I spent 2 weeks outside the Middle East, just, you know, lecturing in French in France, actually. And, you know, I'd seen lots of happy families on the boulevards of Paris and on the canal, you know, beside the canals in Amsterdam. And I got back to Beirut, and the first night I sat on my balcony. I have a nice apartment. It overlooks the Mediterranean with palm trees outside, despite the fact that Lebanon's a dangerous place sometimes. And I looked across the sea, and I did say to myself, you know, I was, what, 59 then, I'm 62 now. And I said, you know, you can't, when you get to the sort of 60 period, you can't run the movie back and start again. You know, you've done a lot of your life already in terms of work. And I remember thinking, you know, was this really how I should have spent my life, watching this appalling pain and injustice and death by violence of totally innocent many people, young children. And I remembered that letter from Louis Heron, you know, which had arrived on a beach in Portugal all 3 decades before. And I asked myself, you know, if I knew them what I know now, would I have taken the job? And the answer was yes, I would.
So do you get to choose your assignments? It sounds like you do.
Pretty much, yes. I'm very fortunate in that I get on very well with the editor of my paper, who's a friend of mine, and the owner, whom I've known for a long time, and my foreign editor is an old friend of mine. Many of them are younger than me now, of course, because I've sort of stayed on as a foreign correspondent when my colleagues have become executive editors, associate editors, night editors in, you know, New York or Washington or wherever. But I get on very well with them, so that if I put up an idea and say, look, I think I should go to Qatar to look at something that Al Jazeera's, you know, talking about, or I should go to Iraq, they say, you know, off you go, good luck, take care. If the editor's particularly interested in something he's read or seen on television, he rings me up, or the foreign editor does. It's a lady, it's Catherine Butler is her name. But they never sort of say, I want you to go. They say, do you think it's worth it? You know, what do you know about this? It's done in a very easygoing way. No one orders me, but, you know, if I feel that they want me to go and cover a story, I'm very happy to do it. And, of course, from their point of view, they're quite happy for me to do, as long as I'm still writing for the paper, they're quite happy for me to go and do lecture tours, book tours, and so on, because then they have me writing from faraway places, and they don't have to pay a penny for the airfare, you see. It goes down very well. I mean, this week I'm writing about the fact that your two presidential contenders are not really wanting to discuss the Middle East. They're a great relief for them. They don't have to. They're now stuck in the economic thing. But also reflecting on the fact, you know, that in a way, I feel that the U.S. administration has gone into this crisis in much the same way it, you know, invaded Iraq. It didn't listen to the Europeans in both cases, who were, in the economic sense, were, you know, insisting on more banking regulations. You wanted the free market, not you, but I mean Bush. Wouldn't listen to the advice of allies. Plunged into the crisis, and then, as usual, the little people get hurt. You know, it's the little people without money who join the Marines to get an education who are being killed in Iraq, and it's the little people with first-time mortgages who are going to get hit by this. I don't think the generals and the managers and chairmen of major investment banks are going to be badly hurt, are they?
So how do you go about choosing where you're going to go at any individual time? Is it from what you read? Is it contacts that give
it's
you a
everything.
Ring?
Yeah, I have got a lot of contacts all over the Middle East. I don't keep any contacts with anything Western. I don't go to Western embassies. I don't go to cocktail parties. In Lebanon, all my friends are Lebanese or Iranian or Egyptian or whatever, and that applies across the Middle East. I think if you're going to hang around embassies to talk to diplomats, you might as well live in London and visit the Foreign Office, or live in Washington and go see the State Department. You don't need to travel for that. So a lot of people ring me up and say, Robert, I think you should come down to Cairo. There's something I want to tell you. That literally happens. Sometimes I'll spot something that would make a wonderful report if you follow it through and take it all the way. I'll give you an example. In 1996, the Israelis, using an Apache helicopter, made here, of course, in the States, fired an air-to-ground missile into an ambulance filled with women and children. They killed 3 children, 2 women. I was just in front of the ambulance when it was hit. And I collected the bits of the missile and got the computer plate and fitted it together. We had to take some of the bits from the bodies. The United Nations helped me, UN troops. And through the Ministry of Defence in London, which was our defence correspondent making inquiries, we worked out that it had been made in Duluth, Georgia by Boeing. And I took all the bits to here to the United States. I got them on Air France to Paris, and then we got amnesty to send them on to Washington. I didn't feel like turning up at JFK with missile parts, you know. You can imagine the reporting of that. And I got it down to the Duluth Boeing Works, and they thought I was writing a story about this wonderful missile. They didn't realize the background to it. And I put the pictures of the dead children and the wounded children on the desk, and I produced all the bits of the missile and laid it down. I said, "Is that your Hellfire or not?" And one of the Boeing executives who was in the boardroom was the designer. Another one was a senior corporate manager in the company. And, of course, there was a flak. There was a PR man there. And one of the men said, "Is this some kind of crusade?" You see, and I said, "I think you should rework your words. Don't use that on me. This is an inquiry into how your missile, came to kill innocent civilians in southern Lebanon." And they were very upset about it. One of them said, "You know, we were soldiers in Vietnam. We don't believe in killing the innocent." I said, "But it's your missile. You know, how'd it get there?" And the line they took was that under the various U.S. export agreements, it is the U.S. government that insists that weapons supplied to a buyer, that the buyer has to abide by basic rules of law, of war, rather. And so basically Boeing was saying, you know, well, we make knives, but we're not responsible if they're used to stab people, you see. So anyway, I ran the story. It was called Return to Sender, because I'd actually got the missile back to the guy who made it and showed him what happened. And the amazing thing was we printed the computer part, right, the whole of the front page of our Sunday magazine in The Independent in London. And the next morning I got back to Beirut on Sunday night. And Monday morning I got a call from a French missile manufacturer. He said it wasn't sold to the Israelis. He said that missile was sold to the US Marine Corps. He asked to meet me secretly in the Lutetia Hotel in Paris. I got the next plane to Paris from Beirut. This is very good for frequent flyer points, by the way. And I got to Paris, and he produced this secret NATO list of codings, and he said Israel is 14 on it, but on the missile, the computer part, it says 01M. 01 is the United States on NATO codings, and M meant Marines. And I called the editor. He said, "Go straight to Washington, find out what the hell's going on, you see. Well, how did a Marine missile get fired by the Israelis?" And eventually, after we contacted the commandant of the Marine Corps outside Washington, I was picked up and invited to meet senior Marine officers in plain clothes in their mess at a Marine base outside. You know, car went in, people saluted at the gate. And I handed all the photographs of... I left the missile with Boeing, of course, in Georgia. I thought they could put it in their museum. I don't think they did. But I had all the photographs, and they went through it. And the story came out very simply. I couldn't quote them by name, but, I mean, I used all the information. It was one of 700 AGM-114C missiles. AGM is air-to-ground missiles, called the Hellfire. The publicity, by the way, was all for one and one for all. They used the Alexandre Dumas quotation from Athos, Porthos, Aramis, and D'Artagnan from the Three Musketeers. Anyway, the Marines confirmed it was one of their missiles. They had bought 700 of them from Boeing and had taken all 700 to use against the Iraqi army in the liberation of Kuwait. We're talking 1990-1991. They found that there was a misfire rate of 50%. Every two missiles, only one exploded, which was very interesting because the helicopter fired two missiles at the ambulance and only one exploded. The other landed unexploded beside a mosque. I found it. And I got the computer plate off that, too. anyway, and the Marines said that they had so many misfires that after they'd used up 350, they didn't use them anymore because they weren't reliable enough. And then they said they were instructed by Washington, by the Pentagon, with many other units with spare ammunition, to leave them at the Haifa Munitions Pier, take them there by boat to Israel. And it was part of a quid pro quo, a gift from the U.S. government to the Israelis for not joining in the war against Iraq in 91. Remember, George Bush Sr. was very keen to keep the Israelis out of that war. And part of the payback for this was to be given all these free munitions that weren't used up. And so this missile had been made in Duluth, Georgia, for the U.S. Marines, taken to Kuwait, then taken into southern Iraq, then taken unused to the Haifa Munitions Pier in Israel, and then used in 1996 in the war between Hezbollah and the Israelis in southern Lebanon. And it was very interesting because we'd actually gone right back through all the people responsible, and not one, including the Israelis, said that they were responsible. You know, if there weren't terrorists, we wouldn't have fired the missile, you see. Terrorists, quote unquote. I mean, we're always hearing about terrorists, 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 terrorists. And, you know, the amazing thing was that you know, Dwight D. Eisenhower, I think, was the person who first invented the phrase, the military-industrial complex. There it was. I went to the industry that made the missile and traced its military path, and everyone it killed was innocent, you know. So that's the sort of story I like to do. I like to follow things right through to the end. I thought it was pretty shameful that not a single American newspaper tried to follow that up. One paper came on the line to me from Chicago and said that they couldn't follow it up because the Defense Department wouldn't talk to them. In other words, the government, by refusing to talk, had effectively censored the story out of the American press. Harper's did publish the piece later as one of those reporting columns at the front of the magazine. But that was it. But I did, in fact, it was a huge report in our magazine. It was, you know, 5,000-6,000 words. It was sort of New Yorker length. And it was published in my last book, even larger, as what happens if you actually try to find who made the bullet that killed the man, so to speak, or the woman or the child. So in this sense, I have a great... I'm very fortunate in that I have an editor who trusts me and who's a friend of mine who says, go for it. You know, jump on the next plane. And but, you know, sometimes if you have a... like, invasion of Iraq, for example. I mean, there was no question that I was going to go to Baghdad. I mean, I'm the Arab affairs correspondent. So I've never been embedded with armies. I went to Baghdad and covered the war from the Iraqi side and traveled around the roads under... I'm always under American air attack. I was at one point in 1991 in the NATO war in Serbia. I was based in Serbia and Kosovo, and I was being bombed by the Royal Air Force, which is a very exclusive experience to go through. And it's very dangerous, but my goodness, the things you see, you know. There was a friend of my parents who was, after my father died, was looking after my mother's affairs, you know, he was a very old man. He was dying in hospital, and I went to see him, and he said, my God, Robert, you've seen things that so few people have ever seen, you know. There you go.
We are talking today with Robert Fisk. He is the Middle East correspondent for The Independent and author of the new book, The Age of the Warrior, Selected Essays by Robert Fisk. It's interesting that Boeing, you're in the hometown of
Boeing. I'm well aware of that, of course, yes. Well, the missile wasn't made at Seattle, but I think actually the same missiles are still made, a modern version of them, but now they're made in Florida and they come under the Lockheed. Because, of course, Lockheed and Boeing had the merger, didn't they, of their weapons manufacturing industry as well as the rest. So, no, I mean, obviously, I know a lot about Boeings because I'm flying on them. About half my life is spent sitting on Boeings or Airbuses. But, but I don't think you make any weapons in Seattle. I don't think you ever have you? I think this is a purely avionics base.
I'd like to do that away from, you know, the hometown crowd.
Yeah.
Although I know they work on some of the, for instance, they were working on some of the stealth aircraft, working on some of the parts.
Well, you know, the globalization of the weapons industry is such that even a small factory in Northern Ireland, which works for Raytheon, it turns out is making some of the components for the cruise missiles, you know. So just about every part of the avionics business at some point is involved in weapons production, even if it's only a tiny computer part. Whether that means that everyone is stained in the responsibility of how weapons are used, I don't know, but it's a... I go to these arms fairs. This is one thing I like to do in the Middle East. You go to the Emirates and they spend millions and millions. They import tanks, missiles, rockets, the like of which you've never seen. And I always go around and interview the Lockheed executives and ask them, you know, how they feel about the use of their missiles. Sometimes they're quite interesting. You know, they've all read George Bernard Shaw's play Major Barbara, which is about a lady who's in the Salvation Army. And she's engaged to be married to the son of a weapons manufacturer called Undershaft. And he has the best lines in the play. He's a brilliantly... You know, many of these guys are very bright, by the way. You know, they're the merchants of death, but they've read great literature, and they like talking about their jobs, you know, and spilling the beans in large numbers into my notebook, which I'm very pleased about. They'd all read this play and sort of thought through the role of Undershaft. Undershaft is not only a very generous man. At his weapons plant, which is in the Midlands of England, it's obviously in the Victorian age, there are tremendous pensions for his workers. They're all got free food in their canteens. They all live in beautiful houses built by the weapons manufacturers. They have very good social insurance schemes if they're hurt in any way. The workers in the plant are very happy. They like their bosses, you see. It's a Boeing dream, isn't it? Especially at the moment, because I know about your strikes on the floor. But, you know, and obviously this play had touched these weapons manufacturers. I'm not talking about the people who the middlemen who take the missiles and pass them on to other people like Iran or Syria or wherever, or Israel. I'm talking about the people who actually make them. And there was a very interesting comment made to me by an Irish bomb disposal officer in the Irish army who was serving in the UN in Lebanon. And he was taking me around his little museum of horrors, you know, unexploded bombs or exploded bombs and photographs of what they'd done to people. And we were looking at one new missile that the Israelis had used to test on a village in southern Lebanon. And the computer components were quite astonishing. I mean, the amount of money it must have cost to make these missiles is just astonishing. And he said, well, Bob, he said, one thing you ever learn, in any business in the world, the one where money doesn't count is manufacturing weapons. So it's an intriguing job I have to be able to chase things to the... I always think there's a lot in common between journalists, criminals, and policemen. And there's a bit of the detective inspector in every journalist who tries to do his job, you know, to hunt things down. And to say, you know, what is the proportion of guilt for this company, this man, this person, this country, this army. Unfortunately, I have a paper that lets me do it. I don't think many papers are that generous. The Guardian, maybe. French newspapers are pretty good. But I don't, frankly, see an awful lot of serious investigative journalism in America now. You know, the sort of Watergate-type things. I don't think you'd get brownie points for rocking the boat on the New York Times.
Do you think that's primarily due to the growing monopolies of media ownership?
No. I'm sure that has something to do with it. I think there's several things. I think there's a sort of... There's a tendency of some journalists, I won't say the majority, to treat journalism as just another job, you know, like running a bank. Well, maybe not at the moment, running a bank, you know, running a radio station or, you know, driving a bus or whatever, or being in real estate. And I think, without trying to romanticize it, I think that journalism should be a kind of vocation, something that has something more to it than just, you know, earning money to pay off your mortgage or, you know, to send the kids to school. But I think particularly in this country, there are two deadening influences. One is that journalists who, you know, I think it's our job to challenge authority, especially governments that go to war, and especially when they do it on a foundation of lies, which is what you and the British government did over Iraq. And I think that journalists in this country particularly feel that to challenge authority when your country's at war might be seen as being unpatriotic and thus potentially subversive. On top of this, I think there's developed in the United States, it's there in Britain and Europe too, I mean, I'm not pinning this just on the US, but I think particularly in America, there's a very parasitic, osmotic relationship between journalists and power. You see this particularly if you... It's something I never recommend. If you watch a presidential press conference and all the journalists are saying, oh, Mr. President, Mr. President, Mr. President. And the president says, yes, John, yes, Mike, yes, Mary. You know, that's the up-down relationship where the journalists sort of cuddle like furry beasts up close to power to be stroked and then to be, you know, to have inside knowledge. And then they write stories saying, officials say, U.S. officials say, U.S. intelligence officers say, always anonymous, of course. And that led us, of course, to the, you know, the scandal in the New York Times where they were printing these endless stories by Judith Miller, founded upon the word of Ahmad Shalabi, of weapons of mass destruction that didn't exist. And the amazing thing is that, you know, after the war, as we know, they carried this huge mea culpa, you know, how the New York Times should have handled the story differently. A long and boring and tedious article, you know, I read through because I'm a journalist. And now they're doing exactly the same about Syria weapons of mass destruction, Iran weapons of mass destruction. We're doing it all over again, and again we're not, well, you, we are also culpable in Europe, not challenging authority, you know. I mean, there's a whole lot of things which we don't have time to go into about the whole Iranian nuclear facility crisis, quote-unquote, that simply doesn't get across to people. It's supposed to be just, you know, the black turban mullahs want nuclear weapons, ouch, stop them. But it's actually a much more nuanced and more complicated story. The person who first wanted nuclear weapons was the Shah of Iran, and we were quite happy to talk to him about it. And he was our friend, he was our policeman in the Gulf, you know. But that part of the story has been sort of snipped off. The fact that when Khomeini returned to Iran after the Islamic Revolution, he actually said, and I was in the, you know, hall where he was speaking, was looking at him, that nuclear facilities are the work of the devil and Iran must close them down, and they did. Until 1984, when Saddam, who of course in those days was supported by us, we wanted him to destroy the Islamic Republic of Iran, started using poison gas, a weapon of mass destruction. Chemical components from United States and Germany, of course. And then at that stage, the military went to Khomeini, the Iranian military, and said, look, Saddam's using weapon of mass destruction. He'll use a nuclear device next. We've got to reopen our nuclear facilities. And that's how the nuclear facilities started running again. Some of them built by the European Union. I mean, the site at Bushehr, which is supposed to be now so dangerous, was built by Siemens, the German company. But this part of the story has been snapped off and thrown into the bin. So you start the story with the black turban mullahs who want to destroy Israel, which they're not going to do because they destroy all the Palestinians and get destroyed themselves and into the bargain. And that becomes the story. And we've been so fixated with Iran, we forgot about a place I go to a lot, which is a Muslim country, which is packed with Taliban supporters and Al-Qaeda supporters and has got a bomb, and it's called Pakistan. But we were not encouraged to look at Pakistan because they were our allies in this preposterously named war on terror, quote-unquote. But again, you know, I have a newspaper that gives me the freedom to chase into these stories and dig them up and write about them, and that's good fun.
Talk a bit more about Pakistan, because we're currently at the point where Musharraf is out. The U.S. has been firing missiles and drones in there with abandon. It looks like things are, I don't know if unraveling is the right word, but it looks like things are going to get worse.
Look, they've been unraveling in Pakistan ever since the creation of the country in 1948. I think there's certainly a lot of Pakistanis tell me that they wish there'd never been partition of India, because India remains a real democracy, whereas Pakistan is totally corrupted. I mean, from the shoeshine boy to the president, via the army and the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, the most powerful institution, security institution, I put the word security in for heavy irony, in Pakistan. And after all, the ISI is thick with Islamists and its leadership. It's an intelligence organ, allegedly reporting to the president, even though I suspect some of the bombs that are directed at the government come from the ISI. It was they who funded and set up the Taliban. And it's they who are now supposed to be acting with the Americans to track down Al-Qaeda, even though they know the Al-Qaeda people very well, and at one point were funded by the Saudis. It was the Saudi intelligence minister who used to meet regularly with bin Laden when he was fighting the Russians. You know, it's all wheels within wheels, but it's not inexplicable. It's not that complex. And the thing about the ISI is, you know, they'll work for the Americans if they're paid. I mean, if you and I want to pay them, they'll work for us too, probably. And they're deeply involved with the Taliban and the Islamists there. I mean, I was covering the trial in outside Karachi. It was a hot, squalid day, and I went to this courtroom where they had some of the people involved in arranging the kidnap of Daniel Pearl. Not the men who murdered him so savagely and cut off his head, but people who were involved in driving cars or whatever. And I knew Daniel Pearl. When I was badly hurt on the Afghan border in 2001, he and his wife looked after me, and in fact he gave me all his contacts books so I could, because I lost my contacts book when I was being attacked. And so I had a very strong feelings to find out what happened to him. And what was very shocking is that when I went through all the court papers, I discovered that Daniel Pearl had telephoned the contact he was to meet for dinner, the man who arranged his own kidnapping. Of course, he was a bad guy. You know, Daniel Pearl thought he was going to meet a contact, right? Mm. And he made the phone contact with this guy sitting in the office of an ISI officer outside Karachi. So that guy knew what he was doing and who he was calling and why. You see? That puts a new stain on the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency. And now the Americans blame the ISI for trying to blow up the Indian embassy in Kabul 3 months ago, you see. And I was talking to a U.S. Special Forces officer who came to one of my lectures in Manhattan in New York not long ago, and he said, we go in plain clothes to Islamabad and we tell the security authorities that we believe this Al-Qaeda person is living at, you know, 22 Acacia Avenue, Karachi, or wherever. He said every time we get there, they've just left. They've been tipped off by the security forces, of course. So it's a totally corrupted society, including the president, you know, who's known as Mr. 10% and was creaming off money when he was previously in power, when Mrs. Bhutto was around. And, you know, I don't... corruption is a kind of cancer. It is in all societies. But when every institution of state is corrupted, as is the case in Pakistan, it's very difficult to know how to reform it, because you can't sort of weed out the bad guys. They're all bad. They're all incriminated. I mean, even when I drive from Peshawar to Islamabad, there's a bridge over a huge river, and always the police stop my taxi and shake down my driver, and I get out of the car and argue and shout and rant And when I'm going back again, the same policeman stop me on the other side of the bridge and shake down the driver again, or try to. I mean, you know, I like Pakistanis very much. They're very smart people. I like going to Pakistan. It's an incredible story to cover, but it is very depressing because I don't see the way out. I don't see how. I mean, better to have a democratically elected government made up of thieves than a general who's a thief, who's a dictator. But that's about the only difference you can say. And, of course, people have lost their belief. Actually, many have not lost their belief in democracy in Pakistan, but they're always betrayed because the Democrats, democratically elected people, turn out to be thieves and corrupt people themselves. It's like it's a society that has begun to sustain itself on corruption. It's become part of the economy. You know, I mean, Lebanese politics is very corrupt, but in a much more human way. I mean, everybody knows what everyone else is doing. Nobody gets, you know, killed because they haven't paid up. Well, not often anyway. You know, I once asked a professor at the American University of Beirut if the Lebanese politicians had PhDs in corruption. He said, no, Robert, they are professors of corruption. And my God, the Pakistani leadership are professors of corruption as well. But no, I mean, it's extremely dangerous because they do have nuclear weapons. They have missiles. They can fire long-range nuclear bombs. And would if they were attacked by India, for example. And the Indians have nuclear weapons. And the support for the Taliban jihadi-type Islamists in Pakistan is growing because of the corruption, because of the number of innocent people the Americans are killing in Afghanistan primarily, but also inside Pakistan. And because many Pakistanis are sickened by the way that the United States government just bullies the Pakistani government, of whether they're military dictators or elected, into doing what they want. And I think this is one reason why Zardari, who was at the United Nations yesterday, is prepared to let his soldiers shoot at American helicopters. He's trying to say, look, we're not going to allow the Americans to push us around. At the same time, of course, continuing to take billions of dollars in military aid from Washington.
Talk a bit about Afghanistan as well. We've got a president and two replacements both talking about shifting troops over from Iraq.
I think this is preposterous. We've lost Afghanistan. You know, everybody. I mean, the Afghans defeated the Persians. They defeated the Greeks. They defeated the Russians. They defeated the British in the Victorian age. And they're going to defeat us again on the very same battlefields. You know, half of Afghanistan is now effectively in Taliban hands, certainly at night. We've not managed to really improve the lives of Afghans. We no more care about them really now than we did, you know, after they'd fought the Russians and we abandoned them once the Soviets left. Well, the Soviet army, wasn't it? Yes. You know, we have this pouring NATO troops into a Muslim country. What on earth are we doing there, you know? The democracy of Karzai doesn't exist outside his palace. Suicide bombers have, you know, filtered across from Iraq. Not literally, perhaps, but certainly, you know, the inspiration of suicide bombers. We never saw suicide bombers in Afghanistan. Not once during the whole Russian occupation, and I was going into Afghanistan to cover it, did I ever imagine. There never was a suicide bomber then. This is a whole new weapon that's moved from Lebanon into Palestine, into Iraq, into Afghanistan, against which we have absolutely no protection at all. And, you know, the other thing we have to remember is that this porous border, I love that word porous, that's the cliche newspapers use, between Afghanistan and Pakistan, was not a real frontier. It was drawn up by a British civil servant called Sir Mortimer Durrand. That's why it's called the Durrand Line. And on both sides of this line, it's the same people, Pashtun people, same tribes. For these people, when they go from Quetta in Pakistan to Kandahar in Afghanistan, they're not crossing a border. It's Pashtunistan. And that's what they'd like. If you actually go there, you'll find they're flying Pashtun flags. Not Pakistani flags, not Afghan flags. They're flying Pashtun flags. Then we hear these various generals saying, foreign fighters are crossing the mountains from Pakistan. We're the same people. You know, in many cases, you know, their brothers live in Afghanistan and they have two cousins in Pakistan. This is sort of our version of it. They're the people who live there. And the Taliban are becoming more popular because we're killing a lot of the innocents. We keep bombing wedding parties for some reason. And then claiming we haven't killed them, which is even worse, you know. First of all, you slap someone, then you claim you didn't slap them. On top of that, you know, we're trying to eradicate drugs, which for many of the Afghans is the only way of making money and supporting their lives, family and children. Well, we might want to get rid of drugs, but it obviously isn't working because the drug exports from Afghanistan now are the highest ever in the history of the country. That's UN statistics clearly show and prove that. And on top of that, you know, the government of Hamid Karzai, so democratically elected, is filled with warlords and corrupt people. Karzai's brother is the governor of Kandahar, and he's a warlord and he's corrupt. And then we say, you know, the Afghans should be grateful to us. And then another bomb goes off and we kill more innocent people. It's not going to work. We've lost in Afghanistan. And we have lost in Iraq, by the way. Don't believe in the surge. You know, there was a baker in Baghdad who said to me not so long ago, Mr. Robert, you know, this is a polite way of addressing a man in the Muslim world. Mr. Robert, can you tell me why you, he meant you, the Western military, you see, I'm not military, but he people see, why are you in Kazakhstan and Tajikistan, French Air Force is based in Dushanbe and Tajikistan, flying close air support to the British in Afghanistan? Why are you invading Pakistan? Why are you in Afghanistan? And why are you in Iraq and Turkey and Jordan and Egypt and Algeria? US Special Forces are outside Taman Rasset in the Algerian Southern Sahara. Why are you in Qatar? Why are you in Kuwait and Oman and Yemen and Saudi Arabia? And I didn't have a reply to that. It's, why are we there? You know, we've built an iron curtain there. Incredible. And, you know, I worked out for our Sunday magazine, our paper, you know, we now have 22 times as many military personnel in the Muslim world as the Crusaders had in the 12th century. And then we're surprised that Bin Laden calls us Crusaders. You know, I really think that the only way... I don't believe in the clash of civilizations. I think this is nonsense. But the only way we're going to have a peace and live in peace is we've got to withdraw our military forces from the Muslim world. This is not our land. It is not our religion. They are not our people. And they don't want to be our people. And they don't want us there. By all means, you know, political relations, trade relations, social relations, religious relations, swamp the place with our tourists. They'll enjoy it. But we've got to bring our armies home. That's one thing that's... Over the years in the Middle East, I've come to realize we're always going to offer them democracy and human rights. And they'd probably like some packages of human rights off our supermarket shelves. But we always arrive with our swords and our Apache helicopters and our horses and our M1A1 Abrams tanks and our Humvees. And doesn't work. Doesn't work.
In your writings, you've clearly held our leadership responsible for...
And our leadership in London as well, by the way.
So how much, since here in the U.S. it's supposed democracy, how much do you hold our citizens responsible for the policies that are happening?
Look, I don't use the internet for all kinds of reasons. I hate it, but I get lots of real letters, you know, the ones with stamps on envelopes. And I get 250 to 300 a week, and usually about half of them are coming from here. By people who are reading the internet, of course, and therefore can read my paper on the internet. And both the letters from the United States, sometimes from serving soldiers, military personnel, but usually from ordinary civilians, and the letters from Britain, you know, including, you know, retired pensioned housewives and old old men of 80 and so on, they all ask the same basic question, which comes down to what's gone wrong? How is it that I can vote for my member of parliament or my congressman or congresswoman? And the moment they reach parliament or they go to the Hill, they no longer represent us. They don't say any longer what we believe and what we want them to say. And whether that's because of the party whips, I think you have the same expression in America, the whips and political parties, whether it's because of the lobby groups, you know, the gun lobby, the Israeli lobby, the tobacco lobby, whatever. There's no doubt, and it's very evident in Britain, that there has come a great gap between the people who elect members of representatives to the democracy and the representatives, having been elected, no longer caring about why they were elected. It's a major problem. You know, and it gets hinted at. I mean, every time you have a presidential election, the president-to-be will always say, well, you know, we're really going to change this around. We're going to get rid of the lobby. I mean, I think Carter was going to get rid of the lobbies. It didn't work, of course. And the lobbies, Lincoln was complaining about them, you know. Roosevelt complained about the lobbies. They're not going to go. It's the way your system works here. But... there's no doubt there is an increasing disconnect between the people and the government, and that is very dangerous because this is a democracy at the end of the day. You know, Churchill said it's not a very good system, but it's the best one around. But it's getting more and more distanced from the people, you know, who are meant to be part of the democracy. You know, it's very interesting. You see, what happened with the Iraq War in Britain was that, having sort of laid down their, you know, carpet of lies, the Labour Party persuaded the Tory Party to vote for the war in Iraq. So that effectively neutered conservative criticism of the war once the lies were exposed, because they were also culpable. And it was the press in Britain that became the parliamentary opposition. We became the people to attack the Prime Minister, Tony Blair then, Gordon Brown now. And it's a rather uncomfortable position for journalists to be in and for newspapers. We are not supposed to be the parliamentary opposition. We were not elected. But in fact, you know, it's one of the reasons why editors have suddenly found themselves in a rather odd position of challenging the authority on behalf of Parliament. You know, our editor in London of The Independent says we're not a newspaper, we're a viewspaper, which is one reason why people read us, of course. But I don't know how you deal with that problem. I mean, it would be nice to think that, you know, Mr. McCain or Mr. Obama could do something about it, but I have little doubt that once one of them reaches Washington, it'll be the same old system, just as nothing will change in the Middle East. You know, the poor old Arabs who say, oh, no, Barack Obama, you know, he'll change things. He won't. It'll be the same old unconditional support for Israel, whatever it does, contempt for the Arabs, absolute jealousy and love and envy for oil. You know, and we did invade Iraq because of oil. I mean, if the national product of Iraq was asparagus or carrots, I don't think the 82nd Airborne would be in Iraq, would it, or the 1st Marine Division. So, you know, I just don't see any changes. I think it's a very hopeless situation in the Middle East. I don't see any lights at the end of the tunnel, you know.
So what keeps you going in your current position, and what plans do you have for the future here?
Well, I'm not going to retire, that's for sure. Someone tells me there's some nonsense on the internet that I'm going to retire, but I'm certainly not, and I have no intention of. I think my editor would be very angry if he read that. Look, I suppose, you know, I'm covering a great human tragedy in the Middle East. I mean, war is not primarily about victory or defeat. It's about death. It represents the total failure of the human spirit. And it is very depressing to watch this all the time, and never getting any better, getting worse. I wake up in the morning in Beirut, and I hear the palm trees moving in the wind, and I can hear the sea, and I think, where is the explosion coming today? And usually there is an explosion, either physical or political, you know. But I suppose it's a bit like reading a sort of great novel like Tolstoy's War and Peace, you know, and you're late at night and you're reading it and you're feeling tired and you say, well, it's almost midnight, but I'll just finish this chapter, and then you say, well, just start the next one. You carry on, you read two more chapters, and before you know it, you look up and you can see the dawn in the crack in the curtains, you know, because you want to read the next chapter. And I think, in a way, the reason I carry on is I want to know what happens next.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
You're welcome.
We have just been talking with Robert Fisk. He is the Middle East correspondent for The Independent and author of the new book, The Age of the Warrior, Selected Essays by Robert Fisk.